We're ready now for chapter 13, and we're going to be going through this little by little, as we're on the details today.
Well, I know we talked about this at length previously, but just as a reminder, because my version on this one, which I don't like how it phrases it, it says, I stood on the stand of the sea, but it was actually the dragon, and we did discuss that. But the sand of the sea clearly is talking about the shoreline, because that's where the sea sand is on the boundary between the land and the sea. And I was just looking at my notes here, and that's strategically located between the sea and the land. So that positions the dragon right between the two next beasts that come up. And they are co-conspirators, or actually creations of his. So he brings the first one up out of the sea, and he brings the second one up out of the earth. But the dragon's right there in the center, and even throughout the passage, it's clearly him working through them, giving them authority, inspiring them, basically, yeah, using them as front agents to hide behind. And they share his methods, they share his motives, they share his agenda. But like any despot, he uses people until they get in the way, and then he can dispense with them and betray them.
Yeah, he uses people. I think he uses them up till they have nothing left to give.
Yeah.
But he also uses them until, like you say, they get in his way of his plans. And then he dispenses of them. He is the taker.
Yeah.
You know, in 1 Samuel 8, when Samuel tells the Israelites what a king will do, if you look at that passage of what a king will do, the key verb, and it only works in English because it's implied in the Hebrew, but the key word is he will take, and he will take, and he will take. That's the route of power. Power is about taking. Love is about giving.
And we listened to a whole series a number of years ago at a gathering we had in Texas, and I'm trying to remember the guy's name. I can't think of it, but he died since then. He kept emphasizing all through there the spirit of taking, the spirit of giving. And he said, whenever the spirit of giving encounters the spirit of taking, there's going to be suffering.
That's true. That's very true. Well, it challenges the spirit of giving. Challenges Satan's whole paradigm.
It exposes him.
Yeah.
That's why they had to kill Jesus, because he was exposing them.
He operates on a series of lies that he has not only taught people, but he has believed himself. And one of those lies is there is no way anybody can become unselfish and loving.
See, that goes right to the heart of what became clear to me, even, based on what you taught me a long time ago about the three foundations of civilization, which was, commerce and law and hierarchy. But commerce is the key one. And as I've thought about that for years, it's like, what is it? Well, number one, it's foreign to heaven. Because the
heaven is about giving.
Giving freely, without expectation of return. Whereas trading, you're giving, but you're expecting something in return.
Absolutely,
you're looking for a profit. You're looking for at least something in equal value, if not more. And if you don't get it, now you in your mind and your emotions, a debt is created.
Right.
Well, the whole idea of a debt is an unmet expectation.
Well, it's obligation.
It's an obligation. And none of that ever existed.
No.
It never existed. And when you have enough debts piled up, now you're angry because your expectations are unmet. This is all how commerce worked. And then that's where the violence within comes, because now you're debt collecting and you get violent when you debt collect.
There's a whole host of things that are corollary to this. If you go to the Garden of Eden, there is absolutely no taking. Yeah. There's only giving. Adam and Eve do not pay for their rent. They do not pay for their food. They do not pay for anything. Everything is free. And they are freely given it, whether or not they express gratitude, which I believe in perfection, they did express gratitude. Yeah.
But it's spontaneous.
Right.
It's not an expectation.
No. So there they are in this paradise. And I have called Garden of Eden the Garden of Grace, because I believe grace is an attribute of God's character. It is not something he dispenses out of a dispenser. Like,
with an expectation of return.
Yes. It is something completely part of his character. So we have the Garden of Grace. And sin was believing Satan's lies that we weren't created in the image of God. Mm-hmm. That's one of the lies he infers in Genesis 3, that we were not. You will be like God, meaning, you know, you aren't like God.
Mm-hmm.
So he got that idea across, and then he disabled cause-effect relationships.
He replaced cause-effect principle
mm-hmm.
with reward-punishment principle.
Mm-hmm. I think he left it open for that to develop, and I think he helped it develop.
Yeah.
Even though it's not in the story itself, I don't think he immediately helped it develop, but I think he did as time went on. They had to replace the truth with something, because a lie is the opposite of a truth, and it really is the absence of the truth. So he had to replace something that was something, and that something would be punitive measures. Yeah. And
but it has to look like the truth enough to fool you.
Yeah, but it became external punishment.
Right.
Well, God won't, it was, you won't really die to God will kill you.
Right.
Exactly. That's the trajectory. It took a while for that to develop, but it eventually developed into that. So with that, when it comes to the Babylon, and I don't think it hurts to prime the pump for when we get to Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
Sumerian culture, and sometimes that's just scholars refer to it loosely as Babylonia, even though it's Sumer. Sumerian culture on the plain of Shinar, which is Hebrew for Sumer, really brought out the mechanisms, the human mechanisms by which they made society work. And so originally you have people living off the land, the hunters and the gatherers. And then they begin to try to figure out how to grow crops. How, you know, they multiplied. They didn't scatter to where there was more food. They kept piling themselves up. And so they had to find other resources. So they began to grow crops. And that became very hard work because they didn't have tools to do it with. And where the very beginning of civilization seems to have begun, and this is based on that book I've talked about by Mario Liviani, is the invention of a hoe. Technology.
Agrarian society.
And they began to discover they could grow more crops.
Right.
In fact, they could grow more crops than they needed. And, you know, you tell this to people and they just think, well, that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Because we're way downstream on that line of thought.
And so they grew crops and what do you do with the surplus? Well, you sell it and then you can get all these things that you want. So they started selling, they started growing more and more crops. And then they developed a plow. And then they discovered they could domesticate the ox. And the ox could pull that plow. And by technology, and this is very current mentality, by technology, they could just grow a huge surplus of grain, and then they could transport it, and they could buy gold, and they could buy silver, and they could buy precious stones, and they could buy just anything that they wanted. More than that, if some people did the crop growing, because not everybody had to grow crops, then other people could pursue other interests. And so they kept multiplying, and they began to move into cities. And you know, we talk about the Tower of Babel story as though the tower is the most offensive thing to God. But actually, it's also the city. It's mentioned right there in that chapter.
And the first thing that shows up with Cain is he went out and built a city.
Right. But that's pre-exilic. I mean, pre
right.
Antediluvian.
But that's like a foretaste of
right
the issue with cities.
Right. So they build cities along the banks of the Euphrates. And if you're going to have a city without chaos, the important thing is that you have some kind of control, external control. And so they develop bosses. And then the bosses didn't always get along, so they had to develop leaders over the bosses. And eventually, in early Sumerian culture, is an interesting thing that developed. They built their cities, and there was a priest king that was king over the city. So you had a kind of theocratic government. But something happened. This is quite interesting, and it's temporary. In Sumerian architecture, they put the temple, there became as well, let me back up. After the priest king died away, so I don't know quite how that happened, but they developed a secular king. And they actually separated religion from the state. They had the temple on one side of the city, and they had the palace on the other side of the city, and they kept them separate. Which I find interesting that they would actually perceive that that was a good thing. But that's only temporary. When the Akkadian-speaking peoples came into the picture more, that separation went this way. And it wasn't a theocracy. It was a union between religion and the state. I'll come back to that later when we come to Revelation 18. So there's this whole dynamic that develops. What they found with these villages that dot the edge of the Euphrates River is that some of them were egalitarian. No hierarchy. Others were hierarchical. But in the city, you had only hierarchy. And of course, how the economy worked was on the backs of the slaves. And that became a reason, an additional reason to plunder other people. Not just to get their food supplies, not just to get their amazing things that they had managed to get, but to get their people and to put them in as slaves. Mm-hmm. So that's the a map of this whole economic dynamic and how it worked. And you're right, absolutely right, Floyd. Economics is the basis of everything else.
Yes. the principles that economics runs on, which is outlined prophetically in Ezekiel 26, 27, and 28,
mm-hmm.
which parallels Revelation 18 as the other book in.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I believe it describes what happened in heaven, and then it was repeated on earth, and it's mm-hmm. the template.
Well, it was bound. It was bound to be repeated on earth because Satan brought those civilizations into existence.
That's the very foundation of his design. So of course he's going to set it up on earth.
You know, and he believed in not scattering people, but in putting more people together because you have more power. You can't have power over people if you don't have them around. If they're 2 miles away from you.
You're talking about concentrating.
Yes.
A city is to concentrate people, which, wow, this is feeding into what I'm studying right now, because this difference between seas and waters, which is what launched this whole study I'm doing. And Ian was pointing out that seas are salty. You know, the other waters are fresh. That's the major difference. But then seas, you know, the large seas is where the wind can blow unresisted. And so you have these huge storms that are fed by the heat from the seas, and they can grow very deadly because there's nothing resisting them until they come up on the land, which might be why the sea beast rises first, right? Because there's very little resistance. But all of this feeds into, now I forgot where I was going with that. What did we just say?
Cities, because of the concentration.
Oh, yeah. The concentration of cities is like the power. That's where salt comes from, is the concentration of the salt being distilled from the land. And it gets stronger and stronger and stronger salt. You know, in the Bible, it says the wicked are like the troubled sea and they cannot rest.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says the difference between the seas, which is salty or concentrated, and the other waters, and that's differentiated in a number of places, is that the seas are the restless people, the ones that are agitating, the ones who are described as wicked, whereas the other waters are more peace-loving people. Doesn't mean they're godly necessarily, but they're more peace-loving people. And so it differentiates between these two groups of people.
Yeah. So to take that to Babylon, they believe that creation began with the commingling of salt water and fresh water.
Mm-hmm. And that's coming out of my study too, because this is powerful.
This is the Babylonians love mixtures. If you wonder why there's these peculiar laws in Deuteronomy against dressing with two kinds of material or growing two different crops in your land, the Bible is opposed to mixtures of any kind. But Babylonians love mixtures. They had protective spirits who were cosmic. They were cosmic, but they were also mixtures of animal and human, and animal and another animal, and so like the fish man, or the lion man, or
amalgamations.
They were amalgamations.
Mm.
They loved that. And where you have cities, you have that kind of tendency to mix together a bunch of things that don't cohere, mm-hmm. instead of separating them out.
Mm-hmm. And that's the beast that comes up out of the water. Just amalgamation of all different kinds of beasts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's true.
And what I saw there is that when you said commingling the waters, and I started looking at the history, because I looked up every word in the Bible that had seas. And there's a lot of them. And I just went through them and I started seeing the pattern. In Genesis 1, the very first thing God does after separating the light from the darkness is separating or dividing the waters. Mm-hmm. Well, if there that was a problem, right? The waters.
Okay.
Because right before that, it's called chaos, which is the mingling of the waters. Yeah. And so he's stepping in to separate them now.
See, Floyd, that's actually been noted by a scholar. I think it is Yusoto, who came up with this, the separation as being the central motif of Genesis.
Yeah.
1. A division, separation. And that is a statement, I think Genesis 1 is a very strong statement against Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation. Because that's where you have the waters mingling together.
Mm.
So you have the seas separated from land. You have the light separated from darkness. You have, even in the creation of human beings,
you have the salty water separated from the fresh water.
Yeah, but in the creation of human beings, you have a separation between the man and the woman.
Hmm.
The word is used, the same word is used, that is used for separation elsewhere.
When God took his side and took it out, it's a separation.
That's in Genesis 2, but in Genesis 1, the word used is actually means separation.
Where?
In the image of God, he made them male and female. He made them.
So which word would be separate?
I knew I needed my Hebrew Bible here. Let me admit it. It's bara. Bara, etymologically, is related to Akkadian parau, which means to split, to separate by extended meaning. And this is brought out by a scholar I don't remember now, but I have the article. And he pointed out that you're dealing with secondary meaning. The primary meaning is create, but the secondary meaning is to separate. And how you can almost prove that is if you go to chapter 2, it says, the heavens and earth and all of them, they were completed in the sixth day that God completed all the work that he had done. On the seventh day, God rested from all the work he had done. God blessed the seventh day and made it holy because in it, God rested from all the work. This mutates the Hebrew. He rested from all the work he created to make is how you would literally read it, which makes no sense. But if you read create as separate, he separated to make.
Oh, we just ran into that this morning. A friend sent me Isaiah 45. Where is it? I make
yes,
evil
five,
and I create.
45. You can apply that same principle to that.
Because we were looking at the words and it's like, it's split.
He split it off from.
Instead of create,
it means
to divide.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so
I've used it that way.
All through Scripture, when God is creating, he's dividing and putting things back where they were supposed to be, and then the enemy comes along at the flood. Suddenly, the waters are all mixed again. It's decreation.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the Red Sea, he divides the waters.
Mm-hmm.
When Pharaoh gets in there, he doesn't have faith. So God doesn't have authority to keep the water up, so he lets it go, and the waters are congealed. Right. And which is interesting, because when I read that, I was like, wait, congealed in the heart of the seas. And this heart of the seas theme keeps showing up. And it suddenly came to me, our sins congealed in the heart of Jesus, and that's what killed him on the cross.
The thing I'd like to point out about seas is in the ancient Near Eastern perception, seas were the regions of chaos and evil. And so when you have a monster that lives in the sea, that is immediately a chaos monster. And that's the core of that's runs through the entire Bible. That's how the ancients saw it. So even when you have in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth was formless and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. Formless and void is really a chaotic state. There's nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's nothing but chaos. Because order always takes on form and something.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this chaos state at the beginning of creation, tohu wabohu, and then
the beginning of the creation of this world.
And then the deep, the tahom,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, is a term related to Tiamat. So when Tiamat is simply salt water. And she is a chaos monster.
Mm.
And so Kingu, her consort, who instigates the plot, he becomes slain by Marduk and Ea in order to create human beings from his blood, I should say. And so you have, again, a chaos being slain and put into human beings. But in other words, they use the blood to create the human being. This mm-hmm. motif is very related to certain mm-hmm. views of the atonement.
Yeah, because there's a sense that in the Tiamat description of that ancient mythology, it's from death that comes life. And mm-hmm. I've heard that from many sermons too, that it's from death that comes life. So, you know, to be able to articulate that and understand the differences, yes, Jesus died. Yes, his blood was shed. And so how would you say, and this is what's different there?
I would say that.
Death brings life.
I would say that the blood of Tiamat, I mean of Kingu, became, I'm using a concrete reason right now, it became the corporal part of the human being, of human flesh and body. And those human beings became the substitutes for the gods to do their labor for them, and they became slaves of the gods. That's the rest of the story of using Kingu. So you have substitution, yes. It's not the same kind of substitution. The substitution of Jesus is revelatory substitution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's illustrated by the binding of Isaac in Genesis 22, where in the story you have a father that start out as a father and a son.
Mm-hmm.
And the father is asked to give up his son as a burnt offering.
Mm-hmm.
And the father makes that sacrifice. He goes up to Moriah. He puts his son on the altar. He raises the knife. He is fully giving up his son. And the angel stops him and says, "Do not, father, father." He doesn't address him as father, but the address is to the father. "Father, do not lay your hand on the son. Do not do anything to him." It's the key lines of that story. And immediately he sees a ram caught in the bushes, and the father is no longer the father of the ram. He's a sinner offering that ram. He's a sinner slaying that ram.
Mm-hmm.
And then that revelation, sin, the father does not kill his son. He does not lay a hand on him. He does not do anything to him.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, or rather, what he does is show and demonstrate what sin does, what's how sin leads to death. That's the revelation of the substitute.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the ram illustrates in the story.
And Jesus said, I have revealed you to those you have given me. You know, he specified that his work was revelatory.
Yes.
That he was, you know, that yes. his mission is revealing the Father.
That's a very good point. If you'd like, I can try to find my, So I can't get my hand out for that. It shows the two parts of the story, which scholars have recognized, and they claim that, oh, this is two stories that they doctored. They had to make it not be a child sacrifice later on. And originally Abraham did offer his son and blah, blah, blah. No, it's two parts to a same story to illustrate that the role of the father changes to the role of the sinner. That is so important to understanding atonement. So when Ellen White says that Abraham got that the angels watching this whole scene get a new concept about Jesus' death, that's what they got, I believe. And they may not have fully understood it because they were still pretty locked into send out the lightning and bolts of fire and consume them. They were still that way until Jesus came. But they had a precursor of it.
They at least got the inside scoop ahead of time that it was not God killing his son.
Exactly.
But the dragon has obscured that fact by convincing the whole world to this day that that is, in fact, what happened.
Exactly.
To hide, to mask himself. So, you know, the dragon standing on the shore of the sea, which is the point where God says, thus far, you know, the proud waves of the sea, thus far and no further you shall go. So the dragon sits on that boundary line. And if he can't take over the land with the sea, because there's a barrier, now he's going to synchronize the land and the sea and bring up agents on both sides like Behemoth and Leviathan and gain authority and control over both the land and the sea.
Well, actually, Leviathan is the dragon. That's where, that's the what it lies behind the dragon of Revelation is Leviathan.
It's always sort of in and out that the dragon or this dragon out of the sea is a clone almost of him. Because that beast, the first beast, I think, is the one who goes into the lake of fire along with the false prophet, isn't it?
Yes.
And that is before Satan goes into the lake of fire.
That beast is Behemoth. Behemoth is Hebrew for beast. And so the Leviathan and Behemoth in Job are the beast and the dragon.
Okay, but what would be which of the beasts in Revelation 13 is the one who goes into the lake of fire? And I forget where it is, 17?
It is the beast that is most prominent in chapter 13, that has these seven heads and horns and,
right,
and heads, and he's blaspheming.
And all the other, I mean, the second beast gets the world to worship the first beast.
That's
and
the
then
second
the image
beast.
Gets people to worship the first beast.
The second beast disappears in Revelation after his entree.
So that beast, even though he looks and acts just like Leviathan, because he gets his authority and he gets everything from the dragon.
Well, he gets his authority from Leviathan.
Right. So he's the one that goes into the lake of fire in, what is it, 19? I think it might be 19. And then it's after the millennium that Satan goes into the lake of fire. And it specifically identifies it as where also were the beast and the false prophet. So it's saying, okay, they've already gone there. Now the true villain is exposed. So and that's the actual dragon. But yeah, the dragon and Leviathan and the beast are so similar that, well, they're almost amalgamated. They're like chameleons. You can't tell which one you're talking about sometimes.
It's the beast and the false prophet that are thrown into the fiery lake.
And they're first introduced in this chapter, which is the first beast, right?
Oh, yeah, you do have the false prophet in here.
It doesn't even mention false prophet till you get all the way over there and you're like, what? What's that about? Unless the false prophet is the second beast.
Well, if it causes to worship the beast, that could be.
And it wouldn't be the image of the beast, would it? I don't know.
Well, it does parallel. If you look at parallels in Revelation, it does parallel the image to the beast.
So the image would be the false prophet.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it does seem like the second beast just sort of evaporates.
Yeah.
He serves his purpose and then...
And that's typical of Hebrew writing. I mean, you have that a number of places, particularly when dealing with the problem of evil. You know, Satan appears and disappears in the book of Job. Elihu suddenly appears and then disappears.
And that's so like Satan to use people and then they disappear. You know,
yes.
It is. Use well, you and then you're disposable. You're just these little pawns and you're there and then you're gone.
When he gets defeated, when he gets defeated, he disappears.
I'll use you and I'll protect you and I'll support you as long as you're winning.
Yeah.
As soon as you start losing, you know, he's great at gambling. And as soon as you start losing, buddy, you're done.
So I'm a little fuzzy just because I didn't get much sleep last night. But so what we're trying to do now is get a little bit a bigger overview, or we're trying to go back and be specific with chapter 13.
I think we just got on a roll. I'm afraid wouldn't have an exact end game of what we were doing. Okay. One thing led to another. And, Here we are
getting into the details. We did the overview last week.
Yeah, we did the overview last week, and so we're supposed to be doing the details.
Which we got real heavy into ocean and seas and dividing and beast. And I think it is important to note here at the beginning of the chapter, and you have sort of mentioned it, but the very word beast, you know, and the implications of all the attributes of beast, because it's really easy, particularly for Adventists, to just hit the default switch and it's like, oh, that must be the Catholic Church, or oh, that must be the United States, or no, we need to let the words and the context and the Old Testament and everything actually inform us as to why that word is chosen, and not go to the conclusion that somebody's drawn and then work back from there.
Right. I don't think we even work back. We just accept it tacitly and move on. What is interesting, I just spotted this. Said the dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. And then the next time he stood on the seashore. He's in the liminal space, what is called liminal space by scholars. When there's something very transient, it can go either way. And there's a little bit of ambiguity, and you're in the space where it can go for good or for evil. That's where he's standing here, is in liminal space. And he stands there to bring up this beast that comes out of the sea, which means he comes out of chaos and also out of the people. Because the people, I think I've had to wrestle with this, because in Revelation, the sea means people. But at the same time, you have this overlay of Job where the sea means chaos and evil. So the people is not necessarily a positive term. It is the conglomerate of people, the people who have pressed together and become the city kind of structure. And that breeds all kinds of evil and usually violence.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I don't know if it adds any meaning, but the verse and I can't think of the reference that comes to mind, is when you grow into the gospel and the truth so well that you're not blown about by every wind of doctrine that comes about. And that's in a tempestuous, tempestuous, stormy sea.
And I'm starting to get a sense on this study of the sea is that it's not narrowly defined as people, but it seems to have more to do with the beliefs that people have. It's like their opinions, their beliefs, their disposition. It's more of the spirit of people than it is the bodies of people, I guess is maybe what I'm saying. So when we think of cities, well, yeah, you have a lot of bodies in the same location, but that's not the problem with the city so much as their disposition, their relationships, their, you know, the hierarchical structure, the mindset. So this is where I think it has more to do with the mindset of peoples, which peoples are the ones who have minds, not just people as in so many body count.
That can be true, but the more people you have in less space, the more it breeds that exact problem.
Right. Yeah.
If you were to scatter them out, they wouldn't have, they would be back to nature. They would be back to seeing God in nature instead of power. But immediately when you compress people together into small space, you have power structures and you have violence.
And that's what prisons are all about. Prisons are a concentration of violent people.
Mm-hmm. And they're violent places too.
And they're treated violently.
And a lot of...
It accentuates it.
A lot of... a lot of prisoners never live through it. They die. Especially if they happen to have committed a crime that all the other prisoners hate. Like Jeffrey Dahmer, for example. He never survived prison. He was killed.
And also, talking about the beast rising out of the sea, obviously, as you look at beast and the horns and the heads, this is Satan is behind this, the dragon, but he's also working through human minds that are willing to cooperate. So when you have vast amount of people that are willing to cooperate with the beast, you know, that he's, you know, it talks about the mark of the beast, which we'll be studying later. It's in their minds. They're in agreement. And it's interesting to me. I hadn't thought of that before, even though a long time. Oh, yeah, seas represent multitudes, but it is this alignment, this cooperation, this choosing to, be used by Satan. It seems like that's also a connection for the timing of this and the success. This is a pretty successful amalgamation in terms of evil deeds.
Well, and notice that this beast has 10 horns and 7 heads.
Yes.
He has more power than he has mental capacity. And he has, its horns are decorated with a royal crown. So each horn has a crown. So he's really into authority and government and control. And then its heads, his thinking, is blasphemous. He has blasphemous names, characteristics. And then here's the amalgamation part. He was like a leopard, crafty, sneaking up on you. His feet were like a bear's. One swipe and he gets you. And its mouth was like a lion's mouth, that roar of fury.
And terrifies you.
Yeah. This is the quintessential beast. It has every evil part of every animal.
So it's an undivided beast. You know, this theme of dividing and uniting.
It is. It is a mixture.
Uniting disparate mixtures instead of uniting in one contiguous body that's synchronized with itself. This is all these different kinds of bodies all forced together. That is, this is really the hallmark of Satan's kingdom, is taking all these disparate things and forcing them together.
Right. That's the Babylonian way. It's all about forcing things to work, making them something they're not.
So the dragon,
the Babylonian thinking is all about that. It's foundational to contriving and making things fit that don't, in terms of ideas and principles. So you were going to say something, Floyd?
So the dragon is overseeing this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And even participating, I think, in the creation of this, the amalgamation, yes, of this, yes, beast, and then giving it his own identity. He, mm-hmm, gives it its power. He transfers his agenda and his methods and his motives, mm-hmm, infuses it into this beast. And, mm-hmm, and yeah, it's this amalgamation that he's constantly squeezing things together, but force is the common denominator all the way through this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So every one of these beasts and the image that are all brought up or conjured up, you could even say, all share the dragon's obsession with power, with force, with control, with intimidation, with and compliance. And also these beasts have to be made up of people, because it's actual real human beings who make this composite creature what it is.
Well, they have to worship the beast. You know, the whole point of having creatures or people or beings or idols or anything like that is Satan's goal is to be worshipped. That he has to be God in some way. And he's obsessed with that.
And worship is to emulate and get your identity from. I think it's important to, you know, clarify what worship is, because for me, most of my life, worship was such a vague term. It's like worship could be just like physically bowing to someone. Well, were you worshiping them? Well, I don't know. Some people make a big deal out of bowing, but they don't talk about the reason or why you bowed or anything. Worship is, I've concluded, is allowing someone to define you, or even asking them to define you, acting like them, emulating them, admiring them, wondering after them, even if you hate them, if you're just in awe of them, you're worshiping them.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever you worship, you're going to become like. So that's what's happening in our world today, is, mm-hmm, all these horrific things going on, and we're obsessed with watching the news. We're actually worshiping all the evil that's going on. We're marveling after the beast, because it's all about power and injustice and terrible things happening. And yet we're being seduced into being angry about these things that are happening, and we're becoming like them without even realizing it. That's the really danger of worshiping the beast and marveling after the beast.
Exactly. I think Joshua nailed it when he said, choose this day who you're going to worship or serve. Are they not similar?
Yes, serve is a form of worship. It's it's one of the words for worship.
When we look at the seven heads are where the brains are stored. This is how we think, how we process. And I appreciated Jennings, as he's going through this, he talks about, you know, it's your perspective, your worldview. And he talks about seven religions, major religions, and then talks about the seven heads and then the power, the horn being, how do you implement this agenda, this perspective, this, you know, and whether it was papal Christianity that used the power of the nations for the Inquisition, you know, all around the world and decimated, you know, thousands and thousands, killed thousands and thousands, or communism, which is also decimated peoples that are opposed to their, you know, their mindset. And that helped me because I go, okay, head is a way of seeing things, a belief system. And then the horns are the way that you use power, whether it's a police force, whether it's education, whether he specified some 10 things, which organization, you know, governments do, which I thought was fascinating. How do they use those powers to push their agenda? It's basically, you know, align or we'll use this to, yeah, get you on board with our agenda or to punish you if you don't agree, which for me was helpful because I always heard about that, but it wasn't really clear. What's the heads? What the horn? What's the horns? And that made more sense to me in terms of what do each of those actually help me focus on.
I would like to point out the word authority. A lot of times in Ellen White's writings, authority has a negative connotation. And it seems, we're so used to it, it seems like a benign term, not something threatening. But authority is so often abused.
It turns into authoritarian.
Yeah, the kind of authority God has is so different from our earthly kind of authority that it can hardly be called authority, because he has a consensual government. It's kind of springing off of what Nancy was telling us. I had an interesting, and you're probably going to wonder where I'm going on this because I'm kind of breaking thought here, but I had an interesting thing happen last autumn quarter. I teach a class every autumn, for honor students, is called Engaging Scripture. And we talk about hermeneutics, how to interpret the Bible. We talk about inspiration. How does inspiration work? Is it verbal inspiration? Is it thought inspiration? And so one of the things I decided to have students do when I created the class was to read the Quran. That may seem kind of strange, but the Islamic community, especially the more broad-minded, open-minded Islamists, they struggle with the same things we do when it comes to inspiration and how to interpret the Bible. And I thought it might be a safe place for them to discuss those issues and then maybe come back to the Bible. And the other old thing I had in mind was I wanted them to become educated in how to talk to a Muslim if they were to sit on a plane with the Muslim. Mm-hmm. We were going along. We'd read passages in the Bible, read passages in the Quran. We would talk about the Bible first, and then we'd talk about the Quran. And we were talking about what are the differences between the Bible and the Quran. And I had a little student in the class who was an Iranian Christian, former Buddhist. She didn't really want to say she was Buddhist. Yeah, I was raised Buddhist, but I have been reading the Bible, you know, and I am looking at Christianity, and that's kind of where she was. She made this comment that I thought was just profound because it matched my own experience with the Quran. She said, when I read the Bible, I hear my own voice. Mm. When I read the Quran, I hear a voice of another. Mm. And that was my experience. The summer I created the class, I spent most of the summer reading the Quran and highlighting and dividing it up into sections for them to read for topics. And I kept hearing this very authoritative voice, very dogmatic, mm-hmm. very one kind of tone driven into my head. And I have heard that from a religious leader, and I won't tell you which denomination, but I have heard that same tone of voice from a religious leader when preaching. That to me is interesting, because if you were to define the difference between God and all other gods and all other religions, I would pick that. I can hear my own voice when reading about God in the Bible, but I can't hear my own voice when I read this other.
Mm-hmm. So what she's saying is that my identity is drowned out under the demands of this supernatural being ordering me around.
I have no ability to think for myself.
Yeah. And I'm not allowed.
I'm not free.
Freedom. I'm not allowed to think. Mm-hmm. I'm commanded to blindly obey.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, most of Christianity teaches that way. Freedom seems to be the least valued aspect of the gospel. It just amazes me that so few people have any interest in freedom, and it's fast evaporating what little there is.
Yeah.
I wonder, why do you think that is?
They want freedom for themselves. They're like the Puritans who entered America. They wanted religious freedom, yes, but not for anybody else.
I think that's it. Selfishness bites it. I'm wondering, Floyd, anybody else? Thoughts?
Once you lose value for freedom, now you're not going to see any problem with making laws and enforcing laws to maintain order and avoid chaos and anarchy and stuff. And it's like, well, when push comes to shove, you know, God's going to have to use violence. And I'm meeting that very same spirit even in our churches.
I think you're jumping where I'm going. My brain tells me that Satan has attacked God's character. God is love. Love equals freedom. Attack mm-hmm. freedom? You got no freedom. You got no love. You got no God. If there's no love, there's no God.
Well, you become God.
Well, you got it. Yeah, that's back to what you were saying.
And the weakest link in that view of God is freedom, because freedom doesn't fit our agenda or our desire to be in control. Right. And particularly in a church setting, we don't see the problem of, you know, handing down orders and a top-down authority. You know, we talked about two different kinds of authority years ago, and I've probably said this too many times already, but years ago, God confronted me and said, we need to talk about authority. Well, mm-hmm. to me, authority was authoritarian. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much what I thought about it, and I didn't even want to talk about it. And he says, you don't know anything about it. That's why we need to talk about this. And so for the next few weeks, it was a huge download of ideas and new ideas and new thoughts and new awareness. And the outcome of that intense study was that I realized that God's kind of authority is bottom up, and that mm-hmm. our freedom to choose for ourselves is what I termed a piece of divinity that God has mm-hmm. given away, respects every being, not just humans, but every being's freedom and right to choose for themselves who they will serve. And he will never violate that authority. He has already dispensed all authority. But the purpose for that arrangement is, if we give that authority back to him with our free will, that gives him authority now to intervene, to get involved, to accomplish things. And that's where our prayers and praises and petitions and the new song has its power, is we are giving God authority. This is completely contradicts the other version of authority, which is top-down hierarchy authority. And that is blasphemy to people who believe that God is at the top of the pyramid of authority. And it's like, what do you mean? We can't give God authority. You know, that's blasphemy. Well, that's blasphemy to their kind of God. Yeah.
It's the doctrine.
The God we worship respects us, and freedom is at the very heart of true authority. And we give our authority, and we willingly serve without no fear, no coercion. And this chapter is the epitome of the opposite kind of authority.
That kind of authority, the top-down kind of authority, is what the dragon invented. And so when you see the dragon, you're seeing authoritarianism. And when you see the lamb, how much authority does the lamb have? And the Revelation talks about following the lamb wherever he goes. How do you follow a lamb? Have you ever tried that with a lamb? You have to want to follow a lamb pretty badly to follow a lamb, because a lamb doesn't know you're following. A lamb just goes where a lamb goes. He doesn't turn around and go, oh, you're following me? Oh, well, okay, I'll change my route here to, you have a little power. You know, a lamb doesn't do that.
It's interesting to me when you were talking specifically about the Muslim religion, and I had referenced the book, Captive in Iran, the two women who were taken captive and jailed at that horrific jail. And they said that the Muslims are so hungry for this personable, loving, caring God, not the dogmatic, authoritarian God. You know, so, and it's interesting to me as we think about those seven heads, which Satan empowers through, you know, the crowns, carrying out the world views, but there's going to be this hunger for something different than that. All those false religions, you know, they're all based on authoritarian gods, you know, where you're supposed to submit and without thinking, follow and obey. You know, you see the Buddhist when they're spinning their wheels, you know, and chanting their prayers. And it's just heartbreaking because it's like this mindless, ritualistic, you know, approach, which Christianity can be ritualistic too. So there is a false Christianity as well. So it just makes sense to me that there is this desire for love and freedom that the lamb shows us this is what God is like.
Yeah.
And those, that's how the beast gets upended by a different kind of use of authority and love.
Sovereignty of God doctrine to me is the worst thing Christians have.
Which means he can kill you if you disagree with him.
It's so he's dogmatic.
But to me, that's critical. It's a very different kind of God, and Satan uses, you know, the mindset of all of those seven heads has to do with how he uses power and force and coercion, pressure. It's all the opposite of
fear and intimidation.
Fear. It's all the opposite. His mechanism, police force, you know, persecution. It's all related to the opposite characteristic of love and freedom.
On that point, too, about freedom, if there's freedom, shoot, the devil doesn't want that because his tool of fear is gone.
That's right.
His tool of the power of intimidation is gone.
Yep.
You know, anybody who's got freedom, you can't intimidate them. You can't make them afraid. You know, they've got what they can't get anywhere else. You know, so.
Yeah, freedom is more than that inconvenient truth. It's got to be annihilated.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the powers that are taking over this world right now are, well, the last few years, you know, they're conditioning everyone to get used to giving up their freedoms, emergency powers, and everything's an emergency all the time. Therefore, you don't have any more rights for freedom. Only we have freedom. We'll make your decisions for you now. Thank you.
Yeah, we're talking
truth and love under assault. Truth and love being truth and freedom.
It's interesting. We were at talking to some the mother of the groom that we're at the wedding for, and she and her husband came from Australia. So I was talking to them about the authoritarian lockdown. You know, Australia was off the charts with what they were doing to people. Yep. So they also were looking at through that spiritual lens of, you know, this is beastly and this is, you know, just a practice run to get people used to accepting these authoritarian measures that are very, I mean, Australia was harsh. I mean, they couldn't fly. Anyway, it was crazy. Some of the stuff he was telling us about, which we'd heard about, but it was interesting.
They set up camps, detainment camps, all kinds of, it's horrific.
Yeah. So you have to look at that through, this is how Satan operates. And this is how he uses, you know, media. This is how he uses education. This is how he uses police force, all those different, the horns, which made more sense to me when I looked at, police force, juries, you know, judicial systems, military, taxation,
government legislation.
It was just interesting to get specific about what are those 10 horns? What do they look like? So anyway, as I mentioned earlier, that was helpful to see it in living color demonstrated for us with COVID lockdowns.
But you know that book that we're talking about, Nancy, have you seen that? Revelation 13 and 17?
I downloaded it.
Oh, yeah. Good. So
I downloaded the PDF.
Yeah, right.
I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about it. I meant to bring it with me, and then I forgot to.
Well, I will tell you that Ian, the pastor that leads the other Zoom calls, I posted it in that group, and he read it, and he called me from Canada, and he said, I really appreciated this. He said he is the first person I've seen that offers an interpretation of the beast that wasn't your typical one, that actually presented it as Satan. And he said, that's what I've thought for a long time. And he said, you know, I really like this. He's written his own book on Revelation a number of years ago.
What's it called?
I don't know. I have it on my shelf at home. In fact, I'm going through a call with him on Revelation, and I've gained a lot of insights from him.
Cool. Yeah, I just think we need to accept other paradigms, and it's kind of a shift from what I heard in all these Daniel Revelation seminars. Yeah, it was pretty narrow.
Yeah.
And to, you know, to step back and study it from a biblical perspective. What do horns represent? Because they could be good or bad. You know, what do beasts represent? And what are the seven hills, the seven heads? Are there some connections? And it made sense to me that these are God perspectives. These are worldview perspectives.
Yes.
And it was fascinating also because at my Sabbath school class, I listened to a...
This is the one we're talking about, right?
We listened to George Barna at a recent interview, and it was startling, his research on worldviews among millennials. And it was very interesting how there is pretty much an intense, only about 4% identified with a... God worldview perspective, only 4%, and their discontent, their difficulties in relationships, it was just fascinating to see the correlation between the worldview that was held and basically kind of life happiness. And it was opposites, as their worldview about a kind benevolent God went down, their personal unhappiness went up. So it was again, worldview perspectives matter.
Becoming like the God you worship.
Yeah. And all in, and connected to, again, what is your worldview? Because you're accepting one, whether you recognize it or not. And media is definitely pushing worldviews, whether mm-hmm. you're aware of it or not. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's tied to.
And AI is infiltrating everybody's minds and thoughts and promoting all kinds of agendas and dismissing all kinds of things. And it's so subtle that most people don't even notice.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're being shaped, and AI is becoming all pervasive. I mean, it's almost everywhere. And I personally, I'm convinced that AI is going to be the image of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
But how could anybody have known before we even had the technology to see it happening? You know, our pioneers, there's no way they could have guessed at that. It would have been total science fiction. And now it's like, you know what? This is a very real possibility. Next time, I would like us to discuss at length. That's why I don't want to do it this time. Why here in verse 1, the crowns are on the horns, but in the last chapter, the crowns were on the heads.
Mm.
Yes.
Good point.
And I don't want the short answer, so.
Right.
Yeah. That's a good point.
But I think it's highly significant, and that's why I'd like to explore it.
Okay, sounds good. I'll have to do some more study.
This is called Theodicy of Love, Cosmic Conflict, and the Problem of Evil. It's a bit dry in reading. It's by John C. Packham. He's a formerly systematic theology, Andrews University Seminary. He is currently serving at the Adventist Review as, I think, associate editor, maybe the theologian editor. He's written a number of books for Baker Academic. He gotten them published. But he is doing pretty much what I could envision doing if I were to doing a theodicy. I think it's going to be a good read. I have only started the first chapter on freedom of the will.
Thanks for sharing.
That's a good first chapter.
Yeah. It's just, I'm such a biblicist and text oriented that it's harder for me to read a book that's systematic theology.
Mm.
It puts my brain in a different orientation. It's the same problem I had with teaching philosophy, religion, my first year of teaching at PUC. I vowed I'd never teach it again, and I never have, because it was so left brain logic. And I had been in a very left brain orientation for many, many years, most of my life, until I entered the doctoral program. And then to do Hebrew Bible thinking, I had to be right brain. And to do both at the same time, because I was still working on my doctorate. And it was just mind bending. And I just couldn't tax my brain that hard. I it's probably because I have a tendency to ambidexterity. And I have, what is it called? Cross dominance in my brain. So I literally have to do gymnastics in my brain to switch from right to left. I can't naturally just jump constantly over back and forth. I believe that because of how I played softball as a kid. I found I couldn't hit the ball right-handed. I had to go to left. But I was right-handed on other things, you know.
Like precision. Precision and accuracy with the left.
Mm-hmm. But I've gotten very right brain because of studying the Hebrew Bible. Hebrew Bible is, well, Hebrew is right to left. It's right brain, a right brain language.
Yes.
And for years, in order to do Hebrew, I had to switch where I was in my brain and go to another place in my brain and then switch it back to my other brain. You know, it was just crazy how I had to do that.
Work.
It was hard work.
Yeah, you had to increase the exercise, your corpus callosum.
Yeah, I sure did. It got easier as time went on. I don't have such a problem now. My brain was not quite right when I was born, I'm afraid. Either that or it's a problem of ambidexterity. I don't think that most ambidextrous people have that problem, though. Anyway, so next week we'll just continue with where we are, and which is almost in the first few verses.
Yeah.
But that was great.
Thank you for everything and for coming. I was delighted when I saw that you were going to be part of us.
I was glad we're going. Oh, little fuzzy brain. So anyway.
Oh, I understand. I had that the other day for the same reason.
Fuzzy brain's no fun. So are you going to close this out, Jean?
Yes, I am. Gracious Father, we thank you for helping us as we wrestle with the beast and the dragon. And we pray that as we do that, we may become less capable of following a beast, following the beast, that we become less capable of wanting to exercise power and control over others, and that we become more and more like the Lamb. We pray for this for next week and for all those who will be here for that next week. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Yeah.